Lecture 26, Does Culture Drive Language Change?
Before we move on in the series, I want to dispel a possible misconception, which would be very easy to fall into given the way language tends to be discussed, especially outside of linguistics, and especially in courses that you may have had on language in college. And this is the idea that the way languages are configured and the way languages change through time is based on and indexed to the culture of the speaker. So this is the language is culture paradigm. To an extent, it's natural that language will interest us based on how it's connected to the culture or the psychology of the people who are using it. But we also have to understand that when we're looking at the natural history of language in the broader sense, that we're kind of missing a point to suppose that all the things that we've been talked about are based on culture. Culture's interesting, but language is actually something which in most ways is separate from culture. So there's an intersection between language and culture that one can study. Many anthropologists have yielded wonderful insights from that. But the language that we're talking about, which is actually most of what language is not something that's indexed to culture. It has a way of morphing and changing and abbreviating and transforming and overgrowing on its own, unconnected from culture. Now, the other way of looking at it that I want to warn us against, and ironically I put it that way, despite the fact that this is a leading paradigm in much cultural study and is always considered promising. But what I want to warn us against is what is generally called the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis. And this is named after Benjamin Lee Whorf, who actually was an amateur linguist who formulated this most explicitly in the 1930s based on work with his mentor, the linguist Edward Sapir. And the basic insight of Whorf, or the basic hypothesis of Whorf, is that the structure of our grammar channels the way that we think. Now, as intriguing as that notion is, and as particularly intriguing as it's become in our era when we are much more interested in diversity and embrace diversity more than people did even in Whorf's day, it really has never been proven in any serious way. If you are given it, generally, if you read between the lines, it's a surmise rather than something that's actually been demonstrated. And if you look at the studies that have been aimed at the issue, until very recently they were extremely unpromising, and even today they don't really square in any way with what Whorf was saying. So I want to distinguish the fascinating but actually rather faceless changes that language undergoes as a fascinating system in its own right from, for example, Native American belief systems, the differences between us, the foibles of being Western, and other interesting topics that actually are separate from what we're concerned with in this course. So let's take a closer look at Whorf. Whorf's hypothesis was based most prominently on differences that he observed between languages like English, and he called English part of something you could call standard average European, or SAE. And what he meant was English, and as I've often talked about them, languages related to English, such as the Romance languages and the Germanic languages, all of which are very different, but have a certain kinship compared to all the other languages in the world. So standard average European compared to Hopi, the language of the Hopi Native Americans. And Whorf is to be commended in that he looked at the Hopi language with no preconception that it was primitive, that it was primordial, that it was the language of savages. He had learned the lesson that indigenous languages are complex and interesting in their own right. So there was no sense that he thought of it as lesser than Russian or something like that. That was an important lesson to learn, but he took that lesson further. His idea was that the differences between Hopi and English were such that a Hopi speaker thinks in a different way than we do in really significant ways, that language, in the case of the Hopi, is psychology, and that it is for us too, and that therefore we have different psychologies. And so, For example, he noticed that the Hopi have one word for all things that fly except birds. And so if it's an insect, if it's a flying squirrel, if it's an airplane, all those things are one word, and then there is a word for bird. We, on the other hand, have words like mosquito and dragonfly and airplane and missile and bird. So according to Worf, the idea was that the Hopi person sees this unitary object of the non-avian flying thing. We happen to subdivide that more carefully, and so we see more difference there. Or he noticed that we have one word for water in English, but in Hopi, there's a different word for water that you see in the wild as opposed to water that you cook or wash with. So there are two different words for that. So we have pig and pork. In Hopi, water's different depending on whether you see it sitting on the ground or whether you've got carrots boiling in it. So his idea was that this means that a Hopi person sees water and its types differently than we do. Then, probably the kind of sexiest thing that Worf noticed was that Hopi presumably has no markers for tense. That for the Hopi, the issue of whether something is in the past, present, or future is not important. And so English has all of this business of I had gone, I went, I will go, I will have gone, I'm going now, etc. All of this very finely subdivided. His idea was that if the Hopi don't have this, then this seems to tie into a cyclical conception of time that many Native Americans have often been said to have. And so, one of his quotes on the Hopi was, "Our objectified view of time is, however, favorable to historicity and to everything connected with the keeping of records." That's the Western conception. "While the Hopi view is unfavorable there, too. The latter is too subtle, complex, and ever-developing, supplying no ready-made answer to the question of when one event ends and another begins." So that was his idea. I remember being exposed to the idea of Native Americans having a cyclical view of time in college. It's a sexy idea. You can't help but find that interesting, particularly if you are not a Native American. It even actually seems to embody a certain kind of wisdom. And that track was also what Worf was on. What he was doing was not solely, no science proceeds without a bias, and he was not solely looking at differences between ways that the Hopi presumably think and the way that we think. What he was really moved by was an effort to suggest that the way the Hopi think is better or more spiritually advanced. That is, Worf was a proto-hippie. He wouldn't have recognized the term. Who knows how he would have felt about Woodstock. But Worf would have fit right in with an Abby Hoffman. He was that kind of person, despite coming in a much earlier era. In the era, he was called someone with a leaning towards mysticism. And so there are other quotes from Worf, such as, "Does the Hopi language show here a higher plane of thinking, a more rational analysis of situations than our vaunted English? Of course it does. In this field and in various others, English compared to Hopi is like a bludgeon compared to a rapier." So it's not just comparison. It's that English is crude and Hopi is more sophisticated. And of course, that was based on his impulse, which was especially blazing in linguistics of his era, to counter the idea that native people's languages are primitive. This was something that the Linguistic Society of America, which still lives today as the flagship organization of academic linguists, had been founded in 1924 exactly to address. This was one of the main reasons that linguists came together in a society in the 1920s. So here is Worf, not more than 10 years later, working within that paradigm. So it wasn't only to show that there are differences. Worf was keen on the idea that the Native American has a certain kind of wisdom that we lack, and that tied into a larger cultural current of his day. So this was what was behind Worf's ideas. And as time went on, he became quite explicit in supposing that grammar channels thought. So he said, we cut nature up, organize it into concepts, and ascribe significances as we do, largely because we're parties to an agreement to organize it in this way, an agreement that holds throughout our speech community and is codified in the patterns of our language. The agreement is, of course, an implicit and unstated one, but its terms are absolutely obligatory. We cannot talk at all except by subscribing to the organization and classification of data which the agreement decrees. So, that's a very explicit idea that grammar channels the essence of a human being in a way, or human societies. Now, Worf also specified in various places, as did his mentor Edward Sapir, who was in agreement with Worf in basic outline, that the idea here is not that a language keeps you from being able to think of something, but that a language leaves you much more likely to think of it, that it makes something for you habitual rather than potential, as it was once put. So it's certainly not that we do not perceive that water that's laying on the ground is not interacting with us in the same way as water that we're washing our hands with. But the idea is that if you are speaking Hopi, then you're more aware of these things. Nevertheless, the idea was that the amount of greater awareness was enough to build a whole paradigm upon and worth sharing with the world. This was a strong hypothesis. And as a result, this hypothesis is regularly taught. I myself have listened to a great sucking sound in a room when I present it to undergraduates, and you can always be sure that if people have a choice of topics, there will be a few papers from students who grew up with another language exploring how their thought processes seem to be different because of the other language. Usually that is a Japanese or Korean student, where their languages have various levels of honorifics depending on who you're talking to and what you're talking about, and they'll often posit that that aspect of the language leads them to be more sensitive to hierarchy and respect distinctions than Westerners, and so on. As I've said, it's a very sexy idea. However, it hasn't been proven. It's as simple as that. I hate to rain on the parade, but not only is it not really what we're talking about in this course, but no one's ever proven this. It's always an idea whose time has not quite come, where more research is necessary. If you look in an introductory textbook for anthropology, you will find it mentioned, but then always in these terms of surmise. And even if the author or authors of the textbook know that this has never been proven, the fact that they put it in the textbook shows that they know that they couldn't get it by other anthropologists checking the textbook before publication without mentioning it, which shows that within the industry there is a notion, after 70 years of lack of proof, that this is still some sort of going concern. So, what are the problems with the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis? These are the things that you don't hear about as much. One of them is that Worf was an amateur linguist, and God bless the amateur linguist, but part of his amateurism was such that his analysis of Hopi was wrong. Like, for example, even based on this course, you might even think to yourself, how likely is it that a Native American language spoken by a relatively limited group of people in terms of numbers and rarely learned by outsiders would not have nosed like the curious cat into marking tense distinctions? If you're looking for a language that isn't going to mark tense, chances are it's not going to be a Native American language. And in fact, Hopi definitely has markers that situate actions and events into time. And more to the point, Hopi culture has time-based records indicated with calendars and sundials, and so there are all sorts of wonderful things about Hopi people, but the notion that they're floating around with this timeless sense, which might remind some people of the joys of a narcotic haze or of checking out of this veil of tears, is simply not true. They have time. And so, Worf was well-intentioned, and being an amateur does not mean being an incompetent, and he was not one, but his analysis of Hopi has not stood up to linguistic analysis. So that's the first problem. Then there is an intuitive problem. So, for example, we've seen that many languages mark the difference between how you have your eye versus how you have a chair. That's very common, this alienable versus inalienable possessive marking. Now, if you're going to be really anal about marking degrees of possession, and if we're going to link that to culture, then I would think that you would expect that inalienable possessive marking would be most common in Western cultures, where the idea is gimme, 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 and we have the notion of personal property and the triumph of capitalism and those omnipresent tall buildings. So it would be English that has this, and Japanese that has it, and German that has it, and the last place we would expect it would be the jungle, when actually it's the other way around. A language is much more likely to mark something like that if it's spoken in a kind of region rather than where we live. That's the way it goes. So if there's this correlation between language structure and culture, then how come you see things like this? Inalienable possessive marking is very rare in any language spoken by a capitalist group of people. That's odd, and that's not one for Worf, unfortunately. And in general, the idea that language channels thought can be very attractive when we're talking about languages that we've never heard and people that we don't know. But as much as we want to make sure that we don't denigrate people for being different, we also want to work against the other extreme of suspending all judgment because people are different and because they are not lowly, rapacious capitalist us. And so, for example, let's look at Western European languages. Most of us have probably learned one. And they have, they tend to have grades of knowing. And so, for example, in Spanish, when you're talking about knowing a person, then you use the verb conocer, and then if you know a fact, it's saber. And in French, that difference is connaître and savoir. In German, that difference is kennen and wissen. We English speakers learn that. It's a little odd. It's no big problem. But if we have known French speakers or Spanish speakers or German speakers. Now, maybe science could elicit some sort of indication of this, but just intuitively, have we ever gotten a sense that for them, they are more aware of those two different kinds of knowing than us? It would seem that you couldn't be human without having a very immediate sense that the way you know your friend is different from the way you know what a hypotenuse is. They're very different aspects of experience. Do we sense that we're kind of blunted to that distinction? Do somebody have to shake our shoulders and remind us that these things are different, that our friend is not a fact and that the hypotenuse is not someone we can argue with? I don't think so. It's really just that there are wrinkles in grammars, and how this connects to anything significant about the way we think or culture seems less likely, even in the intuitive sense, when we're not talking about the Hopi, but we're talking about someone who lives next door, or a language that we've had the opportunity to actually dwell upon. Another example. In English, we say scissors, we say pants, and we say glasses. Those things are all marked by the plural. And it's obvious why they're marked by the plural, but we all know that it's a single object. There's no such thing as one pant was painted red and the other pant was painted blue. It's one thing. It doesn't come apart. In Dutch, those same words are singular. So scissors is just schaar, and glasses is just bril, and pants is just broek. But does that mean that we think of scissors as two things, whereas they think of it as one? I've hung out with Dutch people, and I really get the feeling that they feel the exact same way about pants as we do. There's very little difference. They don't seem to think of the pants as more unitary than we do. They're being human, just like us, and it's quite obvious what the nature of pants is. And then there's another problem, which is that very often the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis is discussed on the basis of, for example, the Hopi and English speakers. And Hopi, like most Native American languages, is extremely complicated. So we've got this immediate kind of bulwark against any kind of insult, because all you have to do is open a page of a Hopi grammar and you see this bizarre, head-exploding system of grammar. But on the other hand, we have to think about what we're saying about thought being channeled by grammar when we think about the real variety among grammars in the world. So, for example, the Chinese languages are very telegraphic compared to a language like Hopi. So tense is marked sometimes, but often not. You might get like distinctions, but in general, you certainly don't have the careful cutting up of tense that you have in English. There's no such thing as a definite article or an indefinite article. And in general, if you translate Chinese word for word, you almost start wondering exactly how do they convey richness of information? And they do, but it's in a very different way than us. And Chinese gets especially complicated in its tones, but not in terms of how much it packs into a sentence. So what are we saying about how they think? It's one thing to talk about the romanticness of the Hopi, but what about a language like Chinese where you might look at the grammar and wonder if they say much of anything at all? That doesn't seem to get talked about very much. There was one experiment where somebody looked at that nature of Chinese and suggested that maybe the Chinese are a little less sensitive to associations between events than we are, things that require the expression of words like although and if. Needless to say, that person wasn't allowed to play any more reindeer games anymore because this time the Westerners came out ahead. So you have to be very careful with this kind of paradigm when you look at all languages as opposed to the ones that happen to interest Worf. Then there are experiments. People throughout the years have certainly tried to support Worf scientifically on this. And the thing is, it never really comes out in a very interesting way. So, for example, Navajo. Navajo has different verbs for handling things depending on their shape. A lot of Native American languages have a kind of a shape of things fetish. A lot of languages do. It's not a European thing, but it's common around the world. And so if you're handling something and it's long and flexible, I presume that that means something like pasta. What's long and flexible? A dead snake. I don't know. But the word for it is shanle. But if you're handling something that's long and rigid, like a big giant pencil or recorder or something like that, then the word is shanti. So it's different. So the idea is that Navajo seems to have this grammatical sensitivity to the proportions and the shapes of objects. Now, there was an experiment. It was a small one, but let's face it, all experiments can't be like an FDA test. It was a small but interesting experiment. Navajo kids, if given a whole bunch of objects, tended more to distinguish them by form and shape rather than by size and color as English-speaking kids did. So English-speaking kids put things together in terms of, this one is big and red, big red, big blue, big red. Whereas the Navajo kids thought of it as form and shape. So the round ones here, the long flexible ones here, and the long stiff ones here. So that seemed kind of interesting, and that was thought of as an indication that the Navajo grammar must shape how you approach the world. But then it was kind of interesting that they did another experiment where black kids from Harlem were more likely to use the size and the color, whereas it was the white kids who tended to use shape and form. So here's a whole different kind of experiment. Not only are the white kids doing something different, but it's a difference that's based on local race and apparently, after we look at all of these Navajo experiments, class issue. So it's not about the Navajo grammar. It's not about specific Navajo culture. It seems to be about something else. And whatever we're going to say about that, it's not what Worf would have predicted. Another Navajo study was interesting. The idea was that the Navajo traditionally have been nomads, and so we would expect a certain sensitivity to motion and going in Navajo. And there was one scholar who noted that Navajo has separate particles that you can put on a kind of all-purpose motion verb so that you can have move on all fours. Then you add another particle, and it's move at a run, or move by flying, or move by floating on water, or move by rolling. So the idea was that these particles that all describe moving in different ways must mean that a Navajo person is very sensitized to motion because it used to be the Navajo way to always be in motion. You can set that to music. It's such a beautiful notion. And I've heard some other linguists talk about verbs of going in the languages of their group and talking about how the group always seems to be going. But first of all, one question is, what people don't move much? You know, I'm not aware of the stationary culture. Even if you are staying in the same place, people walk, people dance, people run. I'm not aware of people where you couldn't say, golly, they move a lot. Even if it's a stationary culture, you might say, well, golly, they love to race. Or, well, golly, they dance every Tuesday night. And more to the point, if you look at Navajo, there is moving on all fours. Well, it's interesting that in English, we also have a way of distinguishing that action. We say crawl. Now, it's not with a particle, but we do have the word crawl. Or they have a particle that means that you're moving at a run. We have a word run, and so on. So Navajo doesn't have single words crawl, fly, run. Navajo has this kind of go verb, and then with the particles, you modify what kind it is. Ours just happen to be single words, but Navajo doesn't have those words. So in other words, English and Navajo are the same. So when they say move by floating on water, we would say float. Those are equivalent sorts of things. So one doesn't want to overly exotify the grammars in a quest to elevate the nature of the speakers. Now, what's important is that there have been examples of experiments where Worf's ideas are confirmed in small ways, and those are important to mention too. There are many languages in the world where the word for green and blue is the same. So there are many languages where you'll have red, yellow, and what linguists often call gru. There's often a gru term, which is green and blue. And we can imagine, you know, if it's 1993, the color teal is very popular. Remember when every second car was teal. It's maddeningly difficult to determine whether those cars are green or blue. Well, for many people, that nexus is such that green and blue are the same color. You can understand that. Now, there's a group of hunter-gatherers in Papua New Guinea. They're called the Birinmo, and they have a gru term. For them, there is no separate green or blue. And there was an experiment done which showed that actually they are rather slow at distinguishing between a green chip and a blue chip. They get it. They're humans. They can see the difference. But they don't distinguish as quickly as an English speaker would. We see a green and a blue, and it's like immediately, oh, well, they're green, blue. For them, I suppose, if you put yourself in the mind of a Birinmo, it's, well, there's a gru one and a kind of a darker gru one. Well, those aren't as separate as red and black here. Then they'll get to those. That's interesting. Or they have two yellows. So where we just see yellow and then another example of that ugly color yellow. For them, there are two yellows. And so if you give them a bunch of chips, they quite immediately separate kind of the bone-colored one from the egg yolk-colored one or whatever the actual colors were. I haven't seen the actual set. And they do that more quickly than English speakers. It's not that English speakers don't see the difference, but for them, it's just poop. Nothing could be more obvious. So that seems to indicate that, okay, your language channels your disposition to the world somewhat. But then we have to remember the claim that's being made. We have someone talking about culture. We have someone talking about ways of thinking and channeling. Now, so far, that experiment shows that there's certain subtle differences in how they see color based on their grammar. Nothing remotely as exciting as what we've been promised. Very recent work has shown that if you ask certain Europeans who have gender what voice inanimate objects would talk in, that this correlates meaningfully with what the gender of the word happens to be in their language. And so in French, table is la table. And more often than not, a French speaker, if asked how a table would talk in a cartoon, thinks that the table would talk like a girl, much more than we English speakers would. Like, this may be my internal craziness. I think of tables as men. If I have to assign any gender to them, because tables have kind of square corners and, you know, are kind of inert, nothing about a table reminds me of a woman. But for them, the table talks kind of like this. Right, that's interesting. But once again, is that culture? You know, for one thing, French people do not walk around thinking about this sort of thing consciously. You have to elicit it very carefully in experiments. And if you've hung out with any French people, you know that their vision of the world does not involve different cartoon voices for objects based on whether they're men or women. And I've asked many Europeans, do you think of these genders, such as Germans with the forks and the knives and the spoons? They say, no, that knife is not neuter. It's just a knife. Now let's eat. And so, these things are very subtle. And in any case, even if underlyingly there are these little blips with the gender and the color, it's nothing like the grammar, channeling, thought, culture, and even disposition that you see in the way Benjamin Lee Whorf was arguing. So, what I wanted to show is that language and culture are not as tightly linked as we're often taught, and that I'm talking about a kind of self-directed change that's mediated by how many people are learning the language non-natively. And that's something that has a kinship with the way natural things develop, like animals and plants. It's linked to culture is something that we can talk about, but not in this course, and not as intimate as we're often told. And the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis in general, as enticing as it is, has never been proven to remotely the extent that is often implied.